On this week's episode of the Fitcast Pulse, we talk about if video games are making us obese, why looking at overweight people makes us want to eat more, and is sugar toxic? All coming up right now. This episode features music by Sabado titled Rebound. You can check them out at subpop.com. Welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast Pulse for Friday, April 29th, 2011. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and along with me is Dr. Jonathan Fass and Lee Peel. How you doing, guys?
Pretty good. Shout out to Prince William and Princess Kate. We understand they're big fans of the Pulse, and sent us a message. Sorry that they couldn't listen live this week, but we, you know, on behalf of the FitCast, we want to say congratulations.
It's so sweet of you to think of them.
Yeah. They've been listening since episode one, apparently. Way back since episode one.
John Williams. Holler. Mm.
No, the Pulse. They don't like the main FitCast. Oh. They think it sucks.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Yeah.
So much for keeping this more on track, but two quick announcements. First off, I'm going to be interviewing Martin Rooney at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time this upcoming Tuesday. You'll be able to come into the Justin TV chat and listen to the interview live, as well as ask questions to Martin. And then on Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, I'm going to be talking with John Romanello. So we're going to have a couple interviews coming up for you next week, and it looks like I have something set up for this this Saturday, so a week from tomorrow, with Brad Pilon. So we have a boatload of interviews coming up for you guys. They're going to be showing up in the feed in the next couple of weeks. Also talked to Tony Gentilcore, who I hope to have interviewed this past week, but our schedules kind of got in the way. But we will be talking about some of the cool stuff that they have going on over at Cressy Performance, including training baseball players, extreme calf races that Tony loves to get into the programs, and maybe we'll have some movie discussion in there, because the summer movie season does start today with Fast Five coming out. It's a great day for everyone. I'm going to be seeing it tonight or tomorrow. So that's it for the news. Let's get into the real news stories. Let's hit it up with the first story that we have that is coming from the Montreal Gazette, that is taken from a study that, John, you were very nice to point this out to me. I really appreciate it, because, you
no
know,
worries.
You know, I'm always interested in some of the research that's being done on kids that play video games and obesity, because they tend to get linked together in a very negative fashion. So this first story that we have from the Montreal Gazette, again, is taking from a study that was in, let me pull this up real quick. You can actually check it out on PubMed. At least you can look at the abstract, but it's from the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario Research Institute in Ottawa, Canada. And what the study did was, is it took two groups of kids, and I'm gonna say kids because it's generally teenagers. They took 22 healthy, normal weight male adolescents, if you want to put it that way, and they did 2 one-hour experimental conditions, namely video game play and rest in a sitting position, followed by a lunch, which consisted of pasta. So what they looked at was the caloric intake between the group that sat there for an hour, played video games, then went and ate, and then the group that sat down and just like watched TV, something that's a little bit less interactive, and then also went and ate. And after the gaming, they consumed an average of 80 calories more at a pasta lunch, and the increase is more significant than it may sound, given that eating only 50 additional calories a day, an apple, for instance, could potentially pack on 28 extra kilograms over 10 years, says Dr. Jean Philippe Chaput, the lead author. I think I did a pretty good job.
That was very nice. That was nice.
Thank you, guys. And again, kind of looking at more of the study itself. And again, I can only go by the abstract, but I want to talk about some of the results where they actually found that, you know, they had increased blood pressure. Like, they obviously, because of the interaction with the video games, you know, there was a physical response. Like, you actually saw that the participants themselves ended up having a energy expenditure that was significantly higher during the video game play than resting. So maybe this caused, you know, a need for or an increase in appetite. So it does kind of make sense there. And I want to also mention that they also profiled glucose, insulin, cortisol, and I always have problems with these hormones, but ghrelin. Thank you, Lee. And it did not suggest an upregulation of appetite during the video game play condition. They concluded that a single session of video game play in healthy male adolescents is associated with an increased food intake, regardless of appetite sensations. So, you know, what did we kind of get from this? You know, Lee, as someone that is very heavy into nutrition and you're always digging into the research, what do you kind of take from this study?
I guess as far as studies go in this aspect, it's something that we kind of see over and over and over again. People in sedentary high stress activities, be it very intense research that they have to do for school or very aggressive jobs where a lot of intensity and passion is required, but no physical expenditure takes place. We usually see that cortisol levels rise. Stress level rise in the body, and what satiates that essentially is multiple mechanisms, but the quick fix satiation of that is carbohydrates or insulin raises, because it's what blunts the effects of cortisol. It's what blunts the effects of stress in a short term effect anyway. So it's kind of a, yeah, all right, we've seen that, we've been looking at that, that's kind of something that we know. And I think ultimately what it brings to question for some people who read things like that is, oh, should I not let my kids play video games, or is just playing video games causing me to be overweight, you know, whatnot? And we can certainly bounce back to that. But from a physical standpoint, do I believe there's an actual physical reaction taking place, and has it been researched in other areas that are kind of correlated to that field of say video games or high stress environments? And I think there actually has been other studies done on this in the video game topic, but I do not have them pulled or referenced. But yeah, we definitely have seen that before. So definitely has some backing to it or legitimacy.
John is clearly not looking at the chat. I was going to hopefully have him.
No, I am. I was, but I think that's kind of what it is. It's sort of clear cut and dry, sort of. I mean, I think that I thought that this was more of an interesting article in the idea of how the mechanism might be. You know, it's kind of like we assume that being sedentary is going to make you gain weight and things like that. And this was pointing to a slightly different sort of mechanism to that. And it's not just the act of maybe just sitting down or something. It's, you know, so I thought that was kind of interesting. But this is one of those articles that for me, kind of like Lee was saying, kind of contributes to the body of knowledge that we have already, you know, discussing a research that sort of supports and puts a small spin on what, you know, what we kind of already believe to that is true. And now kind of sort of figuring out exactly what those mechanisms are that cause, you know, why is it that being sedentary would make you gain weight, and why is it that playing video games in and of themselves might be more harmful than just being sedentary? So it was an interesting article. I thought that it was very unique. I'd never really read anything specifically like that before. But
well, I think one thing that I would probably want to know from the study itself is, you know, what kind of games were they playing? Were they playing more like the shooter type that are a little bit more stressful, mm-hmm. when you have literally people shooting at you, or opposed to something that might be more like a more relaxing, like a trivia game, or something that might be a little bit more fun, something that's played in a group. Obviously, if you're playing something that is a little bit less stressful and has a little bit more downtime, like maybe an adventure game where you're kind of just like walking through, you know, a town or a forest and stuff like that, you know, what the difference would be. So maybe it would be better to specify a little bit more in the study, you know, maybe violent video game playing increases food intake, although that becomes a little bit more sensational. I still would like to, I might see if I can talk to some various people and get the study itself to go a little bit more in depth, but that would be interesting. Let's jump into the next story that we have. Lee, why don't you take this one?
In a recent online Time article that I read, it was talking about the title of the article is "Why Looking at Overweight People Makes Us Want to Eat More, Not Less." And this is similar, I guess, in the aspect of your study that you were discussing, because it's one of many in a long line of studies that talk about the effects of being around overweight people or being in the company or friends with overweight people and it leading to you also being overweight. It's somewhat old news in some aspects, but I thought what was interesting about this one is that it took some interesting twists and turns and looked at people that you don't know, just visuals of people, people that aren't your friends, because so much of what we've seen in past research with social behaviors or whatnot is that the people that you surround yourself with are somewhat who you mirror. There's lots of research that say who you spend, your time around starts to make up a percentage of who you are, and that we mirror those in which that we surround ourselves with. So if we're around a lot of people that eat healthy and that work out and train and whatnot, we are more likely to eat healthy, train, work out, and take care of ourselves, and vice versa. If we're around people that are not taking care of yourself or eating unhealthily or being overly indulgent or whatnot, that you will do so as well. Just it's kind of the simplicity of saying everyone else is doing it, so I will do it too. And that's an overly simplistic psychology version. Look at it. But that's what a lot of these studies focus on. But this one was kind of saying is it was saying what they did, and I'll read a little section of it. They put together multiple experiments to determine what kind of an impact sight had on overweight individuals. And in the first, they recruited people just walking through a lobby and showed pictures either of an overweight or a normal person or a lamp, and were asked to rate the photos for future studies, and then allowed themselves to have candy in a bowl, and they say thank you for your time. And they saw that the people who looked at photos of overweight women took significantly more candy than people that looked at normal weighted women or the lamp. They took less candy on average. And so they did this with cookies and they did this with other things. And they found on average that the people that looked at overweight people or who were looking at pictures of overweight people on average ate more food or had different dietary reactions than the people that did not. And I thought that it was interesting. I thought that it was kind of an interesting study and an interesting look at things. There's so much going on right now in sizeism and in weight bias. There's a lot of great research that you can read online. If you type in weight bias, you can read a lot of great full reports that are available in PDF version for free. I think that we move into very extremes in general with class, and we also move in extremes with sizeism. And one of the things that, while I find the study to be interesting, that it makes me kind of more cautious over and over again is the separation between those who are considered to be healthy and in good shape and, I guess, the goal to be achieved, being separated from those who are overweight, don't take care of themselves and whatnot. And I'm sure it's kind of tell as old as time, but I think studies like this in some way, yes, they show certain things, but they also in odd ways kind of induce a certain rationalization to bigotry and sizeism. So I don't know. I thought it was an interesting study and one that might be fun for conversation.
So. Jonathan, do you have anything to say?
Studies like this are always sort of interesting to me. Again, same sort of thing where it's like what Lee was saying is what are, you know, I love the idea that there's, when we conduct research, it's always about what's the one factor. But the fact of the matter is there are so many factors in anything that you study, if it's weight gain, weight loss, obesity, whatever it is. And this is an interesting kind of study that points to something maybe a little bit different than what we would normally consider. You know, it's the psychological effects. It's the you know, just who we associate with, who we affiliate with, maybe who we're surrounded by, whatever it is. These are things that you may not consider on a daily basis. And I think that sort of, you know, a lot of these articles that I post on Facebook or that you read, you know, in the Times or whatever it is, I like them because they point out things that you're probably not really focused on in your day to day. So this was that sort of article for me, but like Lee said, it's also a very interesting one. You know, is it going to lead now? It's like run away from the fatties. You know, it's ridiculous. You know, I mean, you know, and you know, the effect, if this is true, of what that actually means, like how much does that affect you? Does it affect you by 1 pound or by 100 pounds? Like what is the, you know, the individual effect to this association? I mean, my, you know, I've spoken before, my father is overweight. That's the reason why I work out all the time, because I don't want to be overweight, you know, like, so is my association with him positive or negative, you know, in that sense? Could it have gone the other way? And what, you know, so it's, you know, on an individual basis, I think that there's still so much that's involved in creating this issue of obesity, of weight gain. But it is an interesting idea that it's not just about the idea of well, they're eating this, so I'm going to eat it too. But it may actually go much deeper than that.
Mm-hmm. I think the thing that's always most interesting about stuff like this to me is, you know, what makes you know, half the population look at someone who's obese and say, or perhaps, you know, for example, they're at a grocery store, they see someone who's overweight and be like, oh, well, you know, I'm not eating that bad. Maybe I can get, you know, the pint of ice cream today because, you know, at least I'm not that overweight. And then there's the other group that, you know, sees someone who's overweight like John and, or, you know, sees an example. I didn't mean to put it that way, but you know, you see someone who's overweight and be like, oh, I don't want to look like that. I want to make sure I get my workout in today. I'm going to make sure when I'm, you know, at the grocery store, I'm going to get, you know, all the right foods and stay on track with what I'm doing.
Well, it's interesting because it's hard, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, there's always this rationalization and reason of why. It can come down to a little bit of a superiority complex on certain levels. And I think ultimately what I'm always reminded of when I read articles like this is that there is the potential of taking things too far to where you start to dehumanize. And I know that can get into a whole other category of bigotry and sizeism or whatnot. But I constantly, you know, I see things all the time on Facebook, and I'm not an overly prudish person. I'm very open-minded. We know that. But it's funny, I guess, sometimes the things that I get offended by. I see people all the time, they post up pictures of extremely fat or obese men or women on Facebook, and they poke fun. They're always in those demotivational poster kind of things or whatnot. And there's this real sense of degree of superiority and of dismissing people as being lazy. And they've done research and studies, and they've have people they'll show them overweight pictures or overweight individuals, and they'll have them rate, what do you think this person is? And they'll be like, oh, well, I think that this person is a lazy person, or I think this person is this kind of a person, or they're an unhealthy person, whatnot. And based upon obviously their weight or their stature or whatnot, they start to rate the person in a personality sense and a success sense or whatnot. And there's been many studies of this done. It's lots of research on weight bias. And I think that it's an interesting line between what I want for myself and what I don't want for myself, and how much it can influence how you look at other people and kind of more deeper judgments that we can carry of people. And anyway, I think it's just something to be interesting to be self-aware of.
Great point. Let's John, let's go to the very last mm-hmm. story.
Yeah, this one really caught my attention. We'll save the discussion for after, but it's a very interesting article from the famous Gary Taubes, who some of you may recognize the name. He's an independent investigator, which means that he writes. He writes about these things, about health. He's not, I don't believe, Lee, he's not specifically like a medical doctor or anything, right?
He's not a medical doctor, but to the best of my knowledge, if I remember, because I've had lots of arguments involving people citing Taubes, I believe he does have a degree in biochemistry or something like that.
I think that he does too.
I think
too,
he has something like that. Like there's like he has some sort of degree in like biochemistry.
Yeah, I believe he does too. So this is a person that's you know, he's an author and he's an investigator, and he applied physics at Harvard, and then he got a master's in engineering. So, you know, by all estimation. He's a pretty bright guy, and he's got some controversial ideas, because his ideas are maybe slightly outside the mainstream of nutrition. So he definitely has this very interesting kind of following, either love him or hate him type of thing. So he wrote this article called "Is Sugar Toxic?" And the article is generally based on, at least he begins it off with a about a speech that Robert Lustig gave called "Sugar, the Bitter Truth," and that you can find on YouTube. It's actually linked in the article. Basically, what this article is saying is it's an argument against sugar, but it's a very interesting one, because it's describing sugar as being the primary cause of a lot of the problems that we may have attributed to other things, like fat and stress and things like that. And he's kind of making the argument that this could all actually be as a result of sugar, or that sugar could be a very prime ingredient in this kind of stuff. And it's a poison, not like you drink some arsenic and you're dead. The argument here is that this is a long-term poison that over time causes a lot of the issues, and at the end he argues even possibly some cancers. So basically what he does, he starts going through the things that we do, you know, believe with sugar. He does point out that chemically speaking, sugar is all the same. Fructose, high fructose, corn syrup, table sugar, it's all broken down by the body the same way. And that, you know, you get arguments that's controversial in and of itself, because some people do believe that, and other people cite other evidence claiming that there is a difference between the two. He also goes over the argument of why we now, we feel that sugar is probably not good for you anyway, just because it's empty calories. There's no nutritional benefit to it in terms of vitamins, minerals, things like that. So the old standard argument is that if you're eating a lot of sugar, those are calories that could have been dedicated to more healthy choices. And so you're going to, you know, possibly become either obese because you're overeating calories, or you may have some health issues because you're under eating in the important nutrients. The argument, one of the arguments for the health that he goes into, is that sugar is metabolized primarily by the liver, and this may be converted to fat in large doses or quickly eaten doses, and these are based on animal models, and this will then lead to insulin resistance and what we think of as diabetes, you know, type 2 diabetes, or metabolic syndrome even. The next question there is then, how much sugar is too much? Do we know that there's a limit, that if I eat 20 grams a day, I'm okay, but 40 grams a day might be this tipping point and it might be a bad thing? He cites research that had been conducted and position statements that 40 pounds per person per year seems to be a safe limit, does not seem to contribute to any health problems. But when that was written in the 1970s, that means that's 200 calories of sugar a day, which is 50 grams of sugar a day, which is a little bit more than a can of soda. And by estimation, the average American is eating at least double that. So now this brings into question, is this a safe limit as well? Is this too much? Is this too little? What do we know? And the answer is that we don't have answers to that. The issue with diabetes is mostly correlational at this point. And so we don't know exactly, again, how much is too much. Is it just sugar? Is it carbs? Is it obesity? What contributes to type 2 diabetes? He also goes into the problems with heart health. There are two primary arguments. It's either fats in the diet or it's sugars in the diet. The argument that he makes in the article here is it could be both. Not only could it be both, or it could be more sugar or more fat, we don't know, but there's no reason to believe that it may just be one or the other, and they can't be both contribute to the issue of diabetes and heart disease. So this is because of the way that we conduct research. We typically will try to eliminate all other factors and just focus on one factor. And because of that, our medical research has kind of become, it's either one or the other, and it may not be the case. The argument here is that sugar affects the heart through increased triglycerides and blood pressure, which is thought to be caused by fatty livers leading to insulin resistance. So we have theoretical models. Unfortunately, we don't really have any very good actual research models of this happening, but theoretically this could be the case. he does point out that a major limitation of this theory is that there are no intervention studies, meaning that we don't know for a fact. We've given this individual sugar, we check their blood, you know, and their triglycerides and all these things after a year or whatever, and we see a cause and effect. We don't have that yet, but he does point out that there are some studies underway that may give us some clues about this. The final argument is that of cancer, which was very interesting. And he points out the fact that many tumors, cancerous tumors, we know grow off of sugars. That's how they metabolize. That's how they become tumorous. So the idea is that if we cut out these sugars, we may actually be fighting cancer by starving it, by not giving it any ability to grow. But again, this is all theoretical. So he concludes the article by saying basically that, you know, there are a lot of questions that we have about this. This is not fact, but it's certainly, there's kind of like if there's smoke, there's fire kind of argument here. And until we know the answers, the answer for individuals may be to be at least have sugar in moderation, if not cut it out entirely, because if we don't have the answer, is it worth the risk that this may actually be a slow bullet and something that we've blamed other things in our nutrition and our lifestyles and may actually come down to sugar? So the article I felt was actually fairly balanced, surprisingly. I mean, I because I know of Taub's arguments, I kind of expected like a real slam against sugar, and I didn't feel like that. This article really did that. I felt that he did make a point to say that all of this is basically theoretical. It's convincing, but it's correlational. And because it's correlational, we don't really know for fact. But it seems to be that there are a lot of signs pointing to the possibility that sugar in and of itself may be a lot worse for you than we'd previously believed it to be. My thought of this is that I kind of agree with that, that we already know that sugar is probably not good for you, at least not a lot of sugar. You know, we point to soda and cookies and cake and all this kind of stuff. So when I see an article like this, my thought is, all right, you know, what am I losing if I cut out sugar entirely or almost entirely? And then how much, you know, do I cut it out? Do I eliminate all fruits also? Or do I accept fruits but I don't accept, you know, sodas and candy and stuff like that? For me, it basically comes down to the older argument of it's empty calories. So table sugar doesn't really contribute to me terribly well. We do know that post-workout sugar may be beneficial. And so that's a good thing. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I have to have 50 grams of it a day in pure table sugar either. The negatives of it we know that it seems to contribute to body mass, especially if it's in, you know, indulgent calories that's above what we should be intaking. So there's not a great argument for having sugar in the diet, and at least not, you know, excess sugar. And sugar's in everything. I mean, it's in everything. So I think that for me, the take-home message is until we know for certain, stick to your fruits. Don't eat cake and candy and basically live a healthier lifestyle like we pretty much assume we should be doing already, but with the idea that maybe, just maybe, we may be doing something a little bit better for ourselves. I think the worst case scenario if we cut it out is that we didn't really save ourselves at all. All this stuff is wrong, and all we did is save ourselves from empty calories. That's still pretty good. But the best case scenario, if you cut out sugar, is that this stuff really is true, and now you're really contributing to your overall health. And I think in that situation, it's probably worth investigating further.
Lee, what do you think?
Okay. I think there is no one who understands nutrition or health or relationships of those two things with nutrition that would say in any way, shape, or form that excess sugar consumption is good. I mean, I think that is a rock we can agree on, that no one will benefit from an excess consumption of sugar. I think where I have a problem with articles like that is the underlying intention it's trying to make and with the sources in which that it used. One, it used a lot of the wrong models to make some of its arguments, one being the Lustig YouTube video, which is filled with a combination of things that were said that are fine and the combination of things that are said that are so wrong. Like, for example, one of our things that we see time and time again, we hear in arguments about carbohydrates and about sugar, is that ever since its introduction, ever since we started to increase our sodas and eating, you know, lots of cereals or whatnot and whole grains or grains in general, that the obesity epidemic has gone insane. But when you look at the actual numbers, what's increased the most, what we have increased the most in what we eat is fat. That's what we've increased the most by a good solid 4 to even 5% above what we have increased in sugars and in flours and more starch-based processed carbohydrates. We have increased fat. When you go to restaurants and when you go to anything that is public eating, it is not, you know, it is not a potato that's been sliced and served to you that does the issue. It is the fat that it is fried in. Now, I am not demonizing fat by any sense of the term. We know that fat can be good for you. But my point is that a lot of time with these articles, I feel like that we're missing the forest for the trees, because the excess consumption and the excess consumption of all types of calories that can be too extreme for us, both on the side of fat and both on the side of sugar, is more of the issue. And I think the demonization of just sugar, or pointing out just sugar as one of the main culprits, sugar is the reason that we could potentially get cancer simply because of the way that the body processes it. Well, true. And when cancer cells are being fed, they do like sugar, but you can turn over and process protein and do similar reactions. Now, it's a lot harder. And if someone came to me and they said, I have cancer, I'd say, stop eating sugar. You know, go, you know, think about looking into a ketogenic diet. I mean, yes, those are one of the things that I would say. But does that say, oh, okay, well, since that's what can feed it once I have cancer, does that mean I shouldn't eat it at all? And that goes to the point to say, okay, well, someone that has diabetes should very watch their sugar intake and make sure that they don't do X, Y, and Z. But does that mean that healthy individuals should not be affected by these things? And it goes back to, why should we be led constantly over and over again by small minorities and individuals with health problems versus what is happening within the mass majority of studies and what's happening in the research that we're seeing of the overall healthy population? Not to say that there's not room there. I'm just saying that I worry about these singling outs of isolated events and saying, well, because this happens to X, you should watch out for Y. And I think that there's nothing wrong with limiting your sugar intake, but I think people need to be watchful of what that actually means, because you do end up having people that start saying, well, fruit is bad. Oh, okay, well, the potatoes are bad. Well, the only thing that's good is fibrous veggies that have very low sugar amounts in them. And all of a sudden, you are missing out on essential nutrients, because we do need sugar. We do. We need glucose. We need sucrose. We need those things. It feeds our brains. It feeds various tissues in the body. It is a nutrient that we need. If we don't get it, we get sick. So to say, oh, I'm going to eliminate sugar from my diet, is to say you're going to make yourself sick, because ultimately you do need sugar. It's just, what does the sugar come with that matters? That's what the issue, I think, ultimately resides in. What does the sugar come with when you're eating it? Does it come with nothing? Does it come with just pure white table sugar that has absolutely nothing with it? No fiber, no mass mineral collections, nothing. It's just table sugar. What does that do? It does nothing for many people. I think we have no arguments of that. But sugar in a potato comes with a lot of variety of nutrients. It's not just sugar. It's not just energy for getting you through your day. Fruit, same thing, and so on and so forth. And my point is, and I agree with everything that John said, my point is just that I think that it needs to be made clear to people listening to this that and who read an article like that, that to not go extreme and to say, okay, well, I should avoid sugar because sugar could give me cancer. Therefore, I should avoid you know, these type of carbohydrates or carbohydrates in general, because I'm going to die from cancer if I have anything that has sugar in it. And I know that that seems like, why am I talking to the audience? But just Yahoo just read the article of again, more increases in orthorexia and in adult, they're calling it now, adult onset picky eating. But where people are seriously developing disorders based upon being so overly selective and scared of the food that they eat that it's causing them to not eat at all or make very negative poor nutritional decisions because they don't want to get cancer or because they don't want to touch the evil sugar or fruit is bad or et cetera, things like that. So I think that that's the little caveat I want to throw in there just to say that I think that we can all agree that excess sugar consumption does absolutely nothing for you and that it should be balanced of a diet. But let's do be aware in large scale studies that fat is also a serious player and overconsumption is the biggest player, in my personal opinion, of decreased health because that's where the thing shines and it's easier to get overconsumption with fat than it is with sugar. But yeah, I think that overall, that is the little point, the extra point I wanted to make to not ramble on too long.
And I think that it's a good point. It's because you also, it's ironic that I'm not a Paleolithic diet argument in the sense that, is it the problem? And even again, the article kind of points that out, not terribly well, but it does point out the fact that is it sugar or is it an overconsumption of sugar? Yeah. And if you look at the way that you could argue that we would have eaten in a non-industrial society in more native time, so to speak, we're not getting these amounts of sugar. We're designed. There's a reason why sugar is tasty to us because exactly right, the body wants to eat it. It needs it for energy. And if you look at the way that we arguably developed as society, the hunter-gatherer model, things like this, sugar would not be in terribly large quantities. So when you came across an orange tree, you ate all the oranges because it was good for you. And we're developed for that. So I think that there's an important statement in that, there's a reason why we don't eat dog poop, but we sure love sugary stuff. There's one that's good for you and one is not good for you. But at the same time, when is too much too much sugar a bad thing? And I think that that's the more interesting point of the article itself for me, that it's not just potentially the idea of being overweight and whatever, but it's contribution to disease, the possibility of that contribution. And it's the sort of, and again, it's like, if there was no reason to suspect it otherwise, like if the argument here was don't eat an apple, it'll cause you cancer, it would be ridiculous. And you would look at it and say, okay, there's just not nearly enough evidence to even suggest that an apple would be bad for you. But when the argument is table sugar is not good for you, like you said, it's an argument that we can all pretty much get behind because the arguments, the research itself is different one way versus the other, but it all basically comes around to the idea that table sugar, do we need it in the quantities that we eat it? We don't, Huh. So I think that
I think my issue is more because I think it's because of what it causes the absence of.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, we don't know if someone maintaining a healthy diet, if they have 150 grams of sugar in their diet, but they also have vegetables, they have proteins, they have this, that, and the other. Will they be perfectly healthy, fine, have no issues or whatnot? Obviously, we can't test that. We can't test that. And most of the people that have problems with sugar, it also, oh God, is it their family? Is it their this? And it becomes that so many issues and so many things that lead them to overeating or lead them to the consumption of only that fast drive, which initially we made because it was a survival instinct. It's like, we need this. Mm-hmm. Look at this. We produce this amazing thing that we can have instantly anytime we want. And with that, convenience can also come problematic. And I also like to look at the consumption of alcohol. And I think that is another area that we can look at. And a lot of it, there is nothing nutritious about alcohol. Nothing. And you can bring up all the wine studies you want and you can try and pull out all the things that you want to pull out. There is nothing nutritious about alcohol. Nothing. But can there be correlative psychological effects from social drinking, from enjoying yourself, from the so-called simple life of just, you know, having some relaxation? And could that also not be in the same effect of having some sugar and enjoying yourself and whatnot, and living life in a moderative sense? And so could you argue from that standpoint, as you can argue with alcohol, that sugar can be good for you, that sugar can make you live longer, that having 50 grams of sugar a day could actually prolong your life versus people that overly restrict sugar? I mean, you can see where it can go from different aspects of things. And I don't hate the article. I actually don't hate the article. I hate what the article implies, but I hate the kind of subset behind the article a little bit, but I don't hate the article. I think that it's missing the point of where we need to focus, because again, it's not singling out the carbohydrate. It's always people that don't believe in the laws of thermodynamics that usually go to these places. They go to the carbohydrates, or they go to a single macronutrient instead of just simply saying we're eating too much. It doesn't matter if it's sugar or if it's fat. Fat in excess can give you cancer too, by that account. Why not? It's going to cause inflammation. It's going to cause extreme weight of storage of cell growth. Why couldn't it do the exact same thing? If by that biological and chemical standpoint, like why could the fat that you fry your carbohydrates in? And yes, I do think that the combination of the two is the most deadly, but it's the singling out of the carbohydrate and saying, okay, well, just make sure that you just don't get too much sugar, because that's why is it not just, let's just not overeat. Let's just make sure that you get your essential nutrients. And yes, that's too bad for you, but yeah, don't drink yourself into oblivion. Don't chow down on a bag of white sugar. Sure. I think it's a no-brainer, but in a way that causes trouble too at the same time. I guess that's my hidden kind of, not, I don't want to argue with you, just that's my hidden kind of argument with the mm-hmm. with the article a little bit. I don't like the slight implication that's there and that's leaving out other things. But I could talk about it until the end of time and Kevin's
right. That's why I thought you'd like this article. I don't know, the Revetrol research is starting to grow there, pal. I don't know. I'd argue a more direct benefit to red wine than just the sugar from it. I think that the issue here again is the idea that I go back. I understand what you're saying, because I think that it's important, the social aspect, and that almost goes back to what we were talking about in the other articles too, where the idea of that there's never just one contribution. You know, I think what's different with the sugar article is that I don't believe that most people would think of sugar as being contributory to a lot of these. And I thought that's what was interesting, that it brought it out into a bit of a forefront. I agree with you, though. To me, it's not even an issue of what people will do with it. It's just an issue of the fact that it's all correlational at this point. So this gets into the arguments of what do you do with correlational evidence. Correlational evidence is fine. You just can't claim that you know something for a fact, but everything that we know, it came out of correlational evidence at one point. It came from observation, then correlation, and finally we proved it or disproved it. So at this point, is early in that kind of research, that body of research. It goes back to what I would recommend as a health practitioner, you know, in a field that I was qualified to comment on. It's not nutrition, but, you know, I think it becomes the same sort of thing as, like, you know, for an example of physical therapy, we know that anterior knee pain, there is a direct cause and effect for strengthening the quads and anterior knee pain, direct cause and effect. There's miles of research on it. When you come to my clinic and you have anterior knee pain, one of the things you're getting is knee extensions. You're getting quad, you know, stimulation. You're getting to strengthen the quads. I may add some other things too, but I'd be against the research if I wasn't paying attention to the strength of your quad. So then you have to back up and say, so does that mean that I should strengthen the quad in the absence of anterior knee pain? And that we don't know. So I can't tell you, yes, you should, or no, you shouldn't, because we don't know that answer. But is it wrong to say, you know, make sure you're doing your squats right, make sure you're doing your lunges right, and not just for the idea of posterior chain, but also to make sure that your quads are developing strength? And I think the argument that you're making about this is probably the same kind of argument that I make with the idea of the hip dominant and knee dominant exercises and this you know, this stuff that they talk about on the internet of like, oh, they're knee dominant, so people automatically assume that they have strong quads, and that doesn't mean that they have strong quads. It just means that there's a certain movement pattern that they prefer. That doesn't mean that they have strong quads. Excellent. So I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. It's like you just assume because this is, you know, we're calling it this way, you move this way, your quads must be incredible and you have no butt and you could easily be weak all over, you know? So I think it's probably the same argument from my field that you're making here, where it's like, okay, you know, everything can make you fat. It's not just sugar, and everything can contribute to heart disease. It's not just sugar. And, you know, and do we think that just because you're eating, you know, you're not eating sugar means that you can't get this? Absolutely not. So I agree with that too. I think that it's just from the standpoint of not knowing, but having some, I think, reasonable theory here, and having some reasonable correlational evidence, that it's not a bad thing to keep in the back of your mind and maybe give you another reason to avoid the table sugar. But exactly, there's a big difference between saying cut out table sugar and cut out all sugar, which includes fruits and vegetables that are known to be healthy. They're known to be healthy. And then you're dealing with another body of evidence that is also very overwhelming in positive support for fruit and vegetables. So, you know, to take one theory and throw it up against a body of evidence, that's something else entirely.
Great, great point. Great end.
Yeah, I think that's where we're going to end it. So if you have any news stories that you want to send to us to talk about on the show, you can send them to pulse@thefitcast.com. We'll be back next Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time at justin.tv/thefitcast, and we will be broadcasting live this upcoming Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to do the regular show. So hopefully you check all that stuff out. We'll have all the updates for when the upcoming guests and interviews and the schedule is all going to be up at thefitcast.com, and hopefully you'll see some other new stuff popping up there as well in the upcoming days and weeks. So thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.